is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And a reminder to those that are with us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. If you have an observation about the show that you would like to bring up for discussion, or if there's a question you would like for us to direct to our guest in the course of the show, we'll both be monitoring that. And, hey, if you got a better idea than we do, we're more than happy to steal it from you. Also, if you're new to the show and would like to catch up on some that you've missed, or if you have to leave halfway through the show and you want to catch up on the things that you left behind, you can always get the full archive over at Midrats. That's also where you'll find the after show if you're with us live. Right at the 60-minute mark, the audio will go dead, but if we're still talking, it's still recorded, and you can pop into the archive and catch the last couple minutes of the show. And speaking of which, now let's get on to the show. As we put out in some of the pre-show work, it can be argued that since World War II, we have developed an officer corps that has not only developed a record of defeat and in some ways has become comfortable with it. Both good people can agree or disagree on that topic, but it does beg the question, as it's presently structured, is our military leadership sound? In a recent article he wrote, our guest today, titled An Officer Corps That Can't Score, he makes a rather direct indictment of our officer corps in the United States, the structure it works inside, and also some of the cultural and intellectual habits it has developed in the last few decades. And for the full hour, we'll have the author of that article on, Mr. William S. Lind. He is a director of the Center for Cultural Conservatism at the Free Congress Foundation. He has degrees from both Dartmouth College and Princeton University, with some experience in D.C. He worked as a legislative aide for the Armed Services for Senator Robert Taft, Jr., and then Gary Hart until joining the Free Congress Foundation in 87. He's authored quite a few things that I think our listeners will be familiar with once we start rattling them off. He is the author of Maneuver Warfare Handbook from 1985 and was also co-author with Senator Gary Hart of American Can Win, The Case for Military Reform. He also co-authored with William H. Marsher over on the non-military side of the house, Cultural Conservatism Towards a New National Agenda from back in 87 as well. You can find a lot of his most recent writings over at the American Conservative and also traditionalright.com. Looking forward in the closing years of the Cold War, Mr. Lind also co-authored an article that has become really a touchstone that, especially after 9/11, a lot of people were looking at and referencing. The Changing Face of War into the Fourth Generation. That was published in Marine Corps Gazette back in October of 89, over a decade before then, and also has been a strong proponent of fourth generation warfare. Bill, welcome to Midrats.
Quick correction. I retired from Free Congress a couple years ago.
Oh, well, my apologies. That's what I get for using dated information. My apologies on that.
No problem.
Hey, just to kind of start off, I'd like to use as a touchstone today, and we have linked to the article both over at the show page and also at our individual blogs. The article you wrote that really got a lot of people talking, An Officer Corps That Can't Score. And over in the beginning of the article, and I'll quote you a little bit here, it said, quote, the most curious thing about our four defeats in fourth-generation warfare, Lebanon, Somalia, Iraq, and Afghanistan, is the utter silence in the American officer corps, unquote. When you talk about the American officer corps, What type of pay grade, for lack of a better phrase, are you talking about the whole length and breadth, or which group of officers are you specifically focused at?
Well, obviously, in a rigidly hierarchical organization like our military services, this is a problem at the senior levels. This is a problem with colonels and generals, with captains and admirals. There's, in fact, a fair amount of discussion of our problems going on at more junior levels, but those people can't do anything about them. Now, there are still cultural problems. The cultural problems I discuss in the article are present in the younger officers as well, which is to say that most of them do not read serious books about war, and they live in a bubble where they keep telling themselves, oh, no, we win, we win, we've always won every war, et cetera, et cetera. But the structural problems in the officer corps, and again, the astonishing phenomenon that after four defeats, we're not seeing anything at the senior levels about change or reform or adaptation. All we hear is the need for more money, for more of the same old kind of stuff that hasn't worked. That's an astonishing development and a very worrying one. But this is a problem that lands straight in the laps of the general officers because these are top-down organizations.
When you talk about the junior officers feeling that they're somehow, I don't want to use the wrong word, but like an adolescent, they think we've always won. Well, I mean, clearly, the last 10 years have kind of proved that that's not true. On what basis do you get to ride the idea that these officers have been told over and over again that they're immortal or unbeatable?
Oh, I hear this all the time. When I speak to groups of officers at various schools and so forth, I've got a pretty good network in the U.S. Marine Corps that reports back to me, and this is the baloney that's being peddled everywhere. All these generals come down and tell them, you know, you're the greatest, you're number one, no, nobody's beaten us, nobody can ever beat us, they can't even fight us, greatest military in all history, and they lap this crap up. This is a very widespread phenomenon. In fact, a Marine Lieutenant Colonel said to me yesterday that what he is now disturbed about is we're getting the stab in the back legend. He was just down at Quantico, and what he's hearing there is the message is, we did great, but the politicians lost the war. Strictly the fault of the politicians. Everything we did was great. And this is nonsense.
Well, let's pull the thread on that, because I've heard that discussion as well. Eric, I think I've made it on a couple occasions about some specifics, but when you kick off the officer in the when you kicked off your article, and you made the same point that you just did about, you know, not a military voice is heard calling for thoughtful, substantial change, and I especially look at the Army, because since we withdrew from Iraq, there's been kind of this little internecine war in the Army about the coin people who used to be ignored and then rose to the top versus the traditional Army folks that are now trying to come back into power. And there's a lot of talking about coin versus the, you know, traditional Army roles that most of them knew. But I don't think that's what you're talking about. You're talking, I believe, about a change and an adaptation that's much larger and broader than that, not the operational level change, or even in some cases the arguments are tactical, but something broader, a cultural change or a mindset change. What is that change in adaptation you're looking for?
Well, it's the fourth generation war. And what changes in the fourth generation is not simply how war is fought, which is what this battle essentially is in the Army at the moment between the coin guys and the armor community. It is, as Martin Grivan Krefeld puts it, a change in who fights and what they fight for. The central fact that defines the fourth generation is the state's loss of its monopoly on war. All over the world, state armed forces that are designed to fight other state armed forces that look very much like themselves instead are finding themselves facing and fighting non-state forces that look very differently, that in many cases have no uniforms, have no flags, have no rank structure, Virtually none of them have any specialized equipment beyond rifles and RPGs, no fighter planes, no tanks, no artillery, and so on. Almost always they're losing. This isn't simply something restricted to the American armed forces. This is a general phenomenon. The best book on this, by the way, the most important book on war in the last few decades, is Martin Van Creveld's book, The Transformation of War. And that is a phenomenon that goes well beyond the techniques of COIN. When in Afghanistan and to some extent in Iraq there was an attempt to revive some of the COIN and, knowledge that we had, COIN techniques, etc., left over from the Vietnam era, that was a step forward, but it was not sufficient to deal with what is in fact a very different environment from the one in Vietnam where you were facing a state opponent. I mean, one of the problems in fourth generation war is there's nobody to sit down with in Paris and make peace because nobody on the other side can deliver anything but a little slice of the overall problem. There's not one opponent. There are many opponents, in many cases fighting for a wide variety of different kinds of goals, ranging from impressing the local girls to grabbing loot through attaining eternal salvation. And the military has not come to grips with this at all. Again, revival of COIN, fine, but that's by no means sufficient. I taught a seminar for a number of years down at the Marine Corps Expeditionary Warfare School that actually wrote some field manuals for fourth generation war. The first of them, which has gone everywhere in the world except here, FMFM1A, fourth generation war, was actually done by an earlier seminar made up mostly of majors and lieutenant colonels. All the services, we had a couple foreign participants, etc., just met in my living room in Alexandria, Virginia when I lived down there. And yet this is the only manual in the world on fourth generation war. It and the other manuals, by the way, are available on traditionalright.com for those who are interested. We published them as manuals of the Imperial and Royal Austro-Hungarian Marine Corps. If Al Gray were still Commandant of the U.S. Marine Corps, these would have all come out as U.S. Marine Corps manuals, but he's not, and fortunately Vienna has been very supportive. But the U.S. military is still stuck in the past, the U.S. Army particularly, in terms of thinking about COIN. It's more than COIN. It's more than techniques. It is a radically different context.
When you, there's a retired major named Don Vandergrift who
was a very good friend
about,
of mine and who I am one of his mentors.
Okay. Well, he's done a lot of writing about adaptability and or adaptive, I guess,
adaptive training.
Adaptive training.
Adaptive leadership training, teaching people how, and specifically teaching Army officers how to think fluidly and be able to adapt to rapidly changing circumstances. Yes, he's done brilliant writing on this, and he did a terrific job as the number two running ROTC at Georgetown University. I met with some of his cadets, and they were light years apart from what you normally encounter in our officer corps. These were guys who knew how to think and were able to make decisions and take responsibility.
You touched on a little bit about the Marines, and we brought up the Army here, and I've always been fascinated about some of the cultural differences that we have in our services. We've had on some of our regular guests here on the blog, a couple of officers, one of whom is about to retire, that don't mind shaking the tree, so to speak, on the Navy side of the house. But you know, you spend a lot of time with the Marine Corps, so perhaps you developed a little bit of that Masonic loyalty to them. But when you look at the different services, when it comes to being open-minded to hard questions, giving enough oxygen and running room to those really smart senior company grade and junior field grade officers to go out and take an intellectual risk and maybe challenge some things, What are the difference in the cultures that you see between the Army, the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force on a scale of, you know, relatively open and a safe place for an aggressive thinker to be to those places that really, you know, pound the nail that sticks up down?
Well, none of the services do a good job of looking for and promoting the thinkers and the innovators and putting them in positions where they can make a difference. The Marine Corps does a marginally better job. The Marine Corps had a let 100 flowers bloom period where it became the leading service in this country intellectually, starting in the 70s and running up through Al Gray's commandancy, which ended in the early 90s. And then it's been on the downhill slope ever since. The Marine Corps did, under General Gray, adopt third-generation maneuver warfare as doctrine. And that calls for a radically different military culture from the second generation, which is where we are generally stuck. The third-generation culture focuses outward on the situation, the enemy, and the result that the situation requires, not inward on orders, processes, procedures, SOPs, etc. It prefers initiative to obedience. It's radically decentralized, so junior guys make important decisions. And it depends on self-discipline rather than imposed discipline. And this, of course, is the Prussian-German model that they are the people who created the third generation, who created modern maneuver warfare, which, by the way, was conceptually complete by the end of World War I. This isn't a World War II development. It's conceptually complete by 1918. But the Marine Corps hasn't implemented it. In other words, when you look at what the Marine Corps does, and yes, I've worked most closely with the Marine Corps, and I know its strengths, but I also know its weaknesses, and I'm one of its most severe critics, precisely because it does have the potential to become a third-generation organization. I'm not sure the Army does. But the Marine Corps, at most at this point, is maybe generation 2.3. There's a little more room for the thinker, for the innovator, for the junior officer who wants to take responsibility, et cetera. As best I've been able to determine, the horribly slow adaptation we did in Iraq to the kind of war we were fighting, an adaptation that took 4 years before it really even got going, started with Marine captains, company commanders in Anbar province in places like Ramadi, who started, against orders, talking to the nationalist opposition. And that was then supported up the chain in the Marine Corps. It was a bottom-up effort, not some supposedly brilliant general, of which we had many in Iraq, none of whom actually seemed to be very brilliant, coming up with this as some great idea, and certainly not the surge, which was the least important element in the adaptation. The most important was that Al-Qaeda alienated its own base. But this bottom-up initiative in the Marine Corps opened the door to us taking advantage of that. So there's a little bit more room in the Marine Corps, but there's not a lot, and there's not nearly as much as there was in the early 90s. The Marine Corps has gone backwards in that time frame.
Well, how do you see the U.S. Navy and fourth-generation warfare in the context, I mean, historically the Navy has had a theoretical doctrine which has never been followed, but has given a great deal of power and responsibility to its commanding officers of its ships. Where does that fit into your thought process?
Well, that sort of decentralization is central to third-generation war, which, by the way, was not first developed by the Prussian army, starting with the Scharnhorst reforms in the Napoleonic period. That's where it first started in land forces. It was actually developed first in the Royal Navy in the second half of the 18th century and was pretty widely institutionalized in the Royal Navy by the Napoleonic Wars. There is a brilliant book, not on how that happened. Unfortunately, the source material doesn't seem to be there because they weren't writing it down. There's a brilliant book on best naval history in decades on how and why the Royal Navy lost it all in the 19th century and went rigid again, and that is Andrew Gordon's The Rules of the Game. Any naval officer who has any interest in being a professional needs to read that book. But the problems with the Navy are somewhat different. First of all, it's a very curious phenomenon. We're talking here about adaptability, that the U.S. Navy never adapted to the Cold War. It continued to build a Navy centered on aircraft carriers and their various escorts. But the Soviet Navy was overwhelmingly a submarine Navy. The Soviets understood very clearly that the modern capital ship is not the aircraft carrier, it is the submarine. And we were so wrapped around, in effect, getting ready once again to fight the Imperial Japanese Navy, a carrier war in the Pacific, that we let the Soviets outnumber us 3-1 in submarines. We can be very thankful that the balloon never went up on that one. In a hearing, a formal hearing of the Senate Armed Services Committee, one of the senators I was working for, and I don't remember now whether it was Taft or Hart, asked Admiral Rickover, and I quote, "How long do you expect our nuclear-powered carriers would last in a war with the Soviet Union?" And Admiral Rickover's response on the record, again, I quote, was about 2 days, unquote. Rickover at least understood that the capital ship was the submarine. So we have a problem of adaptability with the Navy that goes back now well over half a century. Beyond that, the Navy has potentially very important roles to play in fourth-generation war, because as the state crumbles ashore, water transportation, and indeed control of water for other purposes, becomes ever more important. The only way you can go anywhere in the Congo these days is on the river, because the roads are infected by bandits and the railroads long ago ceased to run. A classic area where the state has ceased to exist for all practical purposes. Someone wrote recently that a journey that in the Belgian Congo took an hour, today takes a day. Well, water routes, both coastal waters and inland waters, become very, very important. The problem is our Navy has virtually no capability in coastal and inland waters. Part of this is that it has no ships suitable for it. I found howlingly funny the notion that we were converting Ohio-class SSBNs, which displace now about 18,000 tons, into submarines for SEAL operations. An 18,000-ton coastal submarine, that's going to be one very nervous submarine skipper. And this touches on a cultural problem in the U.S. Navy, and a serious one, that essentially means that even if you give them the equipment for coastal and inland waters, they can't use it effectively. And that is the rule in the Navy, that if a ship touches ground, the skipper is relieved. I've talked to a number of European navies that have strong coastal forces that told me, we laugh at American skippers when they get into coastal waters. They're scared to death. Because if they touch ground, their career is instantly over. One Scandinavian country showed me a bootleg video of one of their exercises where in the night a skipper ran his missile boat completely out of the water, was totally out of the water on the rocks. And I said, was he relieved? And they said, of course not. So at the moment, the U.S. Navy is continuing to ignore the coastal and the green and brown waters, which is the waters that count in 4GW. It is continuing to prepare to fight those Japanese carriers when they rise from their watery graves, the one sunk at Midway. And it has this internal rule on groundings that mean that even if we gave it some equipment suitable for coastal waters, which, by the way, are not $500 million apiece, the literal ships that we're buying now, they're essentially converted trawlers, which are stealth because they have the signature of any other trawler, that they couldn't use them effectively unless we lift that rule about relieving the skipper who touches ground.
I'd like to bring up everybody's favorite character, but a lot of times when people think of Clausewitz, they think of usually the pictures of him are young, and he died relatively young by modern standards. But you mentioned in your article about the reforms in the Prussian army after 1806, and In, I believe it was 1807 and 1808, Clausewitz was a POW with the French, and then he came back to Prussia in 08. And at the ripe old age of 29, was very instrumental in a lot of the Prussian military reforms that took place at that point. And in your article, you also mentioned, you know, your three structural failures of our officer corps. You know, one of which it has to do with its size. The other was the upper out promotion system, and then waiting until 20 years before you vest for retirement. Is part of the challenges that you see in the officer corps is the fact that we don't really tap down into some of our brightest minds strictly on the basis of age. Yeah, somewhere in our officer corps is an intellectual Clausewitz, but he's a senior lieutenant or a junior lieutenant commander or a major, and is basically told to shut up in color on a regular basis. And do you see any potential benefit that there could be, or any civilian leaders who can look back at the example of, and I'll just stick to two Navy examples because the ones I know the best, where they reached down and got Arleigh Burke as a one-star, and they also reached down deep to get Zumwalt, two characters who were instrumental, at least on the Navy side, of doing some structural change. Do you see any movements and discussion at that point, or is that really not one of the drivers that could lead to some structural change, reaching down deep into the bench and pulling up a strong thinker?
It is very much what needs to happen, but I see no signs of it happening. One of the best rank to work with, I've always found it, again, working primarily, though not exclusively, with the Marine Corps, is captain. I'm talking Marine Corps and Army captain rank here, not Navy captain. At the rank of captain, they have figured out that the bullshit is bullshit, but they haven't become part of the problem. They have not made the transition that is expected at the rank of major if you're going to have serious potential thereafter, which is where you accept that the real world is the world of budget and procurement and promotion politics. The captains remain outward focused, but they're not in love with the institution anymore the way they were as lieutenants. They've reached the point where they can see its flaws. Again, in the Marine Corps, the terrific manuals, field manuals, maneuver warfare manuals that the Marine Corps issued when General Gray was commandant, FMFM-1 warfighting, FMFM-1-3 tactics, most of which I actually wrote, and there were two others. I forget the numbers, but it was campaigning and command and control. Those three of the four were written by a Marine captain, and that's why they're good. And there was no review process, not a formal one. John Schmidt, the captain, worked informally closely with people like John Boyd and myself and Colonel Mike Wiley inside and outside the Marine Corps. And when the consensus had been reached that it's ready, he simply took it to the commandant. In fact, he went up to the commandant's house from Quantico one Saturday morning, knocked on the door, and when General Gray answered the door, John came in and sat down in the kitchen with him and said, "I'm not leaving till you sign it." This was very Prussian. The seminars that I led that wrote the fourth generation manuals, the Beyond the Warfighting manual, FMFM-1A, the two most important are air cooperation and a new light infantry manual. These were written by Marine captains in a seminar that they had to do after hours and for which they received no course credit. So there are a lot of bright younger officers. Unfortunately, they're getting out, and they're getting out in disgust because of what I write about in the article, that they see their seniors seemingly don't care about anything having to do with war. All they care about is money. At this point, most of our senior officers, generals and admirals, frankly, are not soldiers or sailors at all. They are Soviet industrial managers. Like other Soviet industrial managers, they could care less about whether the product works. What they're about is acquiring and justifying resources. Some years ago, and it's gotten worse since, a friend of mine took a Soviet defector this was during the Cold War, around the Pentagon for a week. And at the end of the week, the Soviet defector said, "I understand how Pentagon works. Works like Soviet Union." He was absolutely right. If you talk about war in the Pentagon, you're neither right nor wrong. You're merely irrelevant. It's not a headquarters. It's a bank. And the younger officers realize this. They have no way to do anything except get out, and that's what I see happening. I'm constantly appalled as I hear first one and then another of the best younger Marine officers I know getting out, usually as lieutenant colonels. And there's a Gresham's Law of people as of money. Just as good money, bad money drives out good, so bad people drive out good. And I see this happening very widely at this juncture in our services. Yes, we have Clausewitzes. More importantly, we have Scharnhorst. Let me talk a little bit about Scharnhorst, because he's the key figure here. For a short while, the curriculum was greatly improved at, again, Marine Corps Expeditionary Warfare School, to the point where on the first day, they put up for the whole class two pictures. And they said, "Who are these guys?" And they wouldn't take answers from the Europeans. They said, "No, we know you know. Marines." Well, somebody invariably got Clausewitz, but they didn't know the second guy. The second guy was Scharnhorst. And the major giving the presentation said, "By the end of the year, you will know who Scharnhorst was." Because Scharnhorst was an officer who had transferred from the Hanoverian to the Prussian service. He was unpopular with most of the officers because his uniform was a mess and he was writing books and things. He started and edited a military journal as a lieutenant, had about 300 subscribers, which was quite large for an 18th century a journal. And before the Prussian catastrophe at Jena, which was brought about in part because too many commanders were much too old, which is one of the reasons the Germans failed at the Battle of the Marne in 1914 as well. There's a long history of militaries failing because commanders are too old. Scharnhorst put together the Militärische Gesellschaft, the military society, which included a young lieutenant named Clausewitz, and that met in Salon in Berlin, generally put on by upper-class Jewish women, where they would write papers and discuss them about what needed to change in the Prussian army to bring it out of the era of Frederick the Great. It didn't lose in 1806 because it was no longer the army of Frederick the Great. It lost because it still was the army of Frederick the Great. And they knew this. Well, nobody listened. And the disaster occurs to the point where the Prussian army simply falls apart, and the King of Prussia is left sitting on the riverbank up near Memel in the farthest little reach of his country, which is all he had left, as the Tsar and Napoleon meet on a raft in the middle of the Niemen River to decide whether he still has a country or not. And this catastrophe put Scharnhorst and this small group of reformers in charge, and they were able to make the changes that turned the Prussian army into the best army in Europe for 150 years. And the most important of those was not the structural change that created the famous Prussian General Staff, although that was certainly important. The most important was they made a basic change in the Prussian Army officer corps' culture, which made it different from every other officer corps in the 19th century. They said, from now on, the officer is not responsible primarily for obeying orders. He is responsible primarily for getting the result the situation requires, and he is expected to think about what that needs to be, referencing what his commander, at least two levels up, is trying to attain, what result he's trying to attain. And this became the famous Auftragstaktik in time. And mistakes were permitted, because you cannot have initiative and zero defects, so long as they were mistakes of initiative and not passivity. And this created a radically different culture in the Prussian officer corps that, again, was showed its results in 1864, 1866, and 1870. And, in fact, the Germans were winning the Battle of the Marne when Moltke, the idiot, the junior, lost his nerve and ordered a withdrawal. Much against the Kaiser's wishes. So Scharnhorst is a seminal figure. We have a lot of young officers, I'm sure, in all the services who would love to be a part of a recreated Militärische Gesellschaft. In fact, we had that going for a while in the Marine Corps, again, meeting in my living room. And that essentially put together maneuver warfare for the Marine Corps in the early 80s. These, again, mostly captains from what was then Amphibious Warfare School. So that when Al Gray became commandant, the work had all been done. In fact, when he became commander of 2nd Marine Division, he proclaimed maneuver warfare as doctrine in the division. He did not ask headquarters permission to do that. And again, the work had all been done by a little Militärische Gesellschaft. So the Scharnhorst reforms are very much what has been my model in all of my work on this for 40 years, and it's what our military desperately needs, and we have lots of young officers who'd like to be part of it. But there is no interest whatsoever now in any of the services at the higher level, quite the opposite. I had one Army general at the armor school not too many years ago tell me over dinner, a captain can't even find his own way to the latrine. That's the mindset that pervades the headquarters in all of our services at this point.
And that's a perfect lead-in, Bill. We have on the line a caller, a prior guest, Navy Lieutenant Matthew Hippel, who would like to come on and ask you a question about 4GW.
Sure.
Over to you, Matt.
Thanks, Sal. Mr. Lind, I've been listening to some of your comments, and I'm trying to think of this 4G concept within the model of what we've been doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. So your concern is, in part, this ownership that should be taken up by the officer corps. But you look at operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, and you've got foot patrols, lots of green on blue. You've got an embrace of guys like Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel and their ideas. So you have, in large part, senior leadership saying, I understand conflict, and I will give ownership to a point to these junior levels. But my concern with the fourth-generation warfare model and what you see the military doing within it is the fact it almost seems to forget that there is a job for the civilians. One of our concerns during Iraq was mission creep. Does the military do everything? And we can't. There's the State Department, there's USAID, there's local authorities who have to control their own people. Your concept almost sounds like, let's send in the governor militant who will fix a country, but is that really... I understand the need for more independence, but are we possibly just picking up after other people's failures when we try to embrace this fourth-generation warfare concept?
Well, what we've seen, and this is why 4GW, one of the reasons it's such a challenge in Iraq and Afghanistan, is that as an outsider, regardless of what you do at the level of techniques and tactics, it is almost impossible to win because the essence of the fourth generation problem is the state has been destroyed. And you can't create a new state that has legitimacy because any state created by foreigners has no legitimacy. The very fact that you are foreigners means that any government you create is in effect Vichy. In theory, State Department, etc., should be handling this, but as I'm sure you know, if you've dealt with them, State Department is so bureaucratic internally that it is virtually incapable of doing anything. No State Department employee dares take initiative on anything. If he does, his job, his career is immediately on the line. And it also lives in a la-la land where we can somehow turn every fly-blown, flea-bitten third-world hellhole in the world into Switzerland. Part of the problem, and this does stem from the politicians, although the senior military, again, bears a lot of responsibility, in situations like Iraq and Afghanistan, is we've been given impossible tasks. No one can perform them. No one can turn Afghanistan or Iraq into Switzerland, into a modern, happy, secular democracy with a middle class that is part of the end of history, where it's not concerned about much more but beyond economic growth rates. You can't do this with places like that. And the senior military, again, failed because it didn't tell the politicians, including the president at the time, this can't be done. Exactly as in the Vietnam War, we had no resignations of service chiefs or other senior military leaders over the fact that they were being given impossible tasks, tasks that would have required magic to make them work. That still does not change the fact that even at the more junior levels in the military, we remained in Iraq and Afghanistan primarily second generation, which is to say we reduced war to putting firepower on targets in a contest of attrition. And this is in a type of war where every airstrike, no matter how successful tactically, moves you closer to strategic defeat. The only commander we had in Afghanistan who grasped how the war had to be fought, recognizing again that no matter how you fought it, you weren't going to give the politicians what they wanted, which was a democratic, secular Afghanistan with feminist definitions of rights for women and so on. But even in within the realm of the little that was possible there, the only commander who got it was McChrystal. As I wrote in another column, if every other senior American commander in Afghanistan through the whole war had been replaced by a concrete block, it wouldn't have made any difference. They just kept on doing the same stuff that didn't work. And McChrystal, by the way, was very much resented at the lower levels because he banned the airstrikes. At the lower levels, they said, well, we need those airstrikes. Okay, but each time you call in an airstrike, you move yourself a step closer to strategic defeat. He understood that. He was the only senior commander there who did.
Matt, did you have a follow-on?
Yeah, you know, I've got two, and maybe we could answer them at the same time. Then, Mr. Lind, isn't your concern more than not with a lack of the military's ability to take on the whole pie with this fourth-generation warfare concern, but rather reform in other sectors? I mean, so you have some very strong contentions against innovation going on within the United States military and its officer corps, but it's almost like you point to the military and say you're not innovating in what you need to be, and then we ignore the State Department. So we move on and say, hey, so you guys are absolved. It's impossible for you to reform. Well, we know they both can. So maybe the problem is that fourth-generation warfare is lacking partners for the United States military because your description of Iraq and Afghanistan don't sound exactly like what was going on, like airstrikes, drones, all those things are happening, kinetic destruction of enemies, yes, but foot patrols, construction projects, presence, training, all of these things were things that the military was engaging in. My friends in the Army were doing it. They told me stories about it. So this was real. Guys were on the ground. They were trying to do that hearts and minds project. But if you don't have other partners within it, perhaps the problem then is not on the military side, which is embracing some of these concepts, but rather other areas that we require reform and folks that need to get in on these projects when it comes to non-conventional conflicts.
Well, it isn't either or, it's both and. It's just I'll be the first to say that as challenging as any serious reform of our military is, that of the State Department seems completely impossible. Because from top to bottom, it's institutional culture again is such that they not only have no understanding of 4GW, anyone in there who dares suggest reality, just you know, acknowledging reality, is immediately their career is over. That you have to live again in this bubble. Where we can convert the whole world into Switzerland and everybody's happy democracies, again, with feminist definitions of rights for women and political correctness and all of those kinds of things. And if you say this isn't possible, because I did it at a State Department conference, they literally gasp. Their mouths hang open that someone would dare say that. But it's, again, it's both and, not either or. Yes, there were efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq to do nation building and community relations and all of this sort of stuff, but it was always also constantly mixed in with the airstrikes and the drone strikes and the artillery strikes, and you can't combine the two. Martin van Creveld made the point that one of the few successes against a 4GW opponent was that of the British in Northern Ireland. And he said that a major reason for this, their success is they took more casualties than they inflicted, the British Army. That mindset remains completely alien to our military, as does the notion that firepower and attrition can lose you the war instead of winning it. So the problem isn't either or, the problem is both and. And is it the fault of the State Department, the civilians, et cetera? In part, absolutely. But there's plenty of blame to go around.
Let me shift the focus slightly. In your chapters in the 2008 America's Defense Meltdown, now you discussed the Navy, and one of your concerns at that point was the engineering or technical aspect of a lot of the training of naval officers. And could you kind of address that in light of your latest piece here, the Officer Corps that Can't Score?
Yes. In fact, I did a column specifically on that for traditionalright.com not long ago, because just recently the Navy essentially decided to shoot itself in the head. It decreed that now not only, of course, are the Annapolis grads heavily oriented toward engineering, one of Rickover's less happy legacies, but from now on, almost all of the officers in ROTC are to have math, science, or engineering majors. They're virtually eliminating naval officers with a liberal arts background. And as I pointed out in my column, what this will give us is a Navy that is great at knowing how to do something, but has absolutely no idea what to do. Because that, in warfare, is not a technical question. War is an art, not just a science. It's a disastrous decision. And the engineering emphasis that Rickover created in many ways wrecked the Academy, but now with this new decision, the Navy's decided to wreck its much larger source of officers, which is Naval ROTC.
I thought I'd, if you haven't had a chance to, last year a book came out from one of the regulars we have here on our show, and matter of fact, he's up in our chat room, Lieutenant Commander B.J. Armstrong. He put together 21st Century Mahan, and one of the things that Mahan spent some time on, actually in his first published article, Mahan was titled Naval Education for Officers and Men. And one thing he wrote about was that a focus on science, engineering, and administrative tended, and I'm going to quote Mahan here, to promote caution unduly, substitute calculation for judgment, create trust in formulas instead of trust in oneself, unquote. And that's been kind of a hobby horse on ours here, has been that intellectual imbalance and the impact that that has on the officer corps. Now, one visibility I don't have as much is the other services. Are there other services? Do the other services also have this technical bias? And if not, how much does that critical mass of formula-focused brains have to do with the larger problem you were talking about with the intellectual stagnation that you see at the senior levels of our officer corps?
Well, it's a problem very much in both the Army and the Marine Corps because, again, despite the Marine Corps' formal doctrine being third generation, both services de facto in what they do and what they teach in their schools, et cetera, remain second generation. And second generation war, which was developed by the French during and after World War I, is war by rote process. Nowhere in the Marine Corps are officers ever taught how to think militarily. What they're taught is the intricacies of the French staff process. Everything is reduced to rote process. And this, of course, when the second and third generations met head-on in 1940, the second generation, despite having the French having more tanks and better tanks than the Germans, went down to defeat in 6 weeks. That should tell us something. So you don't have the technical focus except in the air arms, of course, and in the Air Force, that you do exactly in the Navy. But what you have instead, and an equal problem in the ground forces, is a way of war that tries to reduce everything, if you will, to rote technique, to eliminate the art side of war and make everything a technical process. This is a huge problem. In the Marine Corps Expeditionary Warfare School, the captain's level school had been moving steadily away from this and doing much more with tactical decision games and introducing students to operational art and how to think militarily. The new commander there apparently has just given the order to get rid of all of that and to dig out the lesson plans from half a dozen years ago and put them back into service, eliminating all thought and just going back to pure rote learning of process. So the effect, though the cause is different from in the Navy and the Air Force, the effect in the ground services is the same. It kills thought, as simple as that. And it makes sure that the kind of officers who can think militarily give up and get out in disgust because they have no opportunity to do so. I remember Tony Zinni, when he was the commander of the MEF out at Pendleton, telling me, all I can get out of my staff is process, process, process. And I was out there in one situation where the op plan they'd come up with was possibly the worst God had ever seen. And I made that point, and all they could do was go through the process again. Because they don't know anything substantive, they can't even tell when the product of their process stinks. All they know is the process, because that's all they learn in these schools. I would mention, before we run out of time, by the way, and I'm going to be doing a column on this for the American Conservative soon, the canon. There are 7 books which, read in the right order, will take the reader from the first generation through to the fourth. And very briefly, you'll find in the FMFM1A, Fourth Generation War, again available on traditionalright.com, an annotated bibliography of the canon, as we call it, the 7 books. But they're Charles Edward White, The Enlightened Soldier, which is Scharnhorst, Robert Doty, The Seeds of Disaster, which is the development of French Army doctrine between the wars, and that's us. Every American officer who's borrowed my copies brought it back saying, this is us, because that's where we got what we now think of as the American way of war. It's taken wholly from the French. The third is Bruce Goodmanson's Stormtroop Tactics, which is the development, again, of third-generation maneuver warfare in the German Army in World War I. Martin Samuels, Command or Control, British and German Tactics and Doctrine, I think it's 1888-1918, Compares and Contrasts, Second and Third Generation. Again, Robert Doty, he was the chairman of the History Department at West Point for many years. He's the American specialist on the French Army, and it's his book, The Breaking Point, The Battle of Sedan, The Fall of France, 1940. It's now comparing and contrasting the two generations when they meet on the battlefield. Martin Van Creveld's Fighting Power, which compares and contrasts second and third generation U.S. Army in World War II and Wehrmacht as institutions and as institutional cultures. And then finally, Martin's book, which takes you into the fourth generation, which is The Transformation of War. And for naval officers, again, I would add Andrew Gordon's The Rules of the Game. If as one Marine captain, who then was head of instructor development at the basic school, put it to me some years ago, unless the guy's a rock, he cannot read these books in the right order and not get it. They were all grouped, by the way, previously on the Marine Corps Commandant's reading list. They weren't called the canon, but they were all there. They were grouped, and they were in the right order. In the most recent iteration of the Commandant's reading list, which was 2013, they were all gone.
Have you ever had a chance to read Commander, I think then Commander Chris Hayes's Naval War College article on developing the Navy's operational leaders?
No, I have not.
Okay. The question, I guess, is that part of he goes to the history of the fact that the Navy has done a very poor job of leadership training and leadership education, and there's a difference. He makes a distinction between the two. But one of the things he mentions is the idea of developing critical thinkers as part of the process. Is that similar to the thought you have about how the leadership should be developed in the military?
Yes, it's along the same lines. Again, the best work, we've discussed it already, is Don Vandegrift's work on adaptive leader training. Critical thinking, yes, but it has to go beyond critical thinking. It's creative thinking. It is the ability, again, to look at a military situation and see a solution that with the minimal expenditure of lives on your own part and of time, which is always pressure in war, can get a decisive result. As General Herman Balk, who was probably the finest tank tactician of World War II, saved the whole front in the South after the disaster at Stalingrad, put it in an interview he did with for Battelle Institute. This was in the 70s. This is an art. Only a few can do it. Most can never learn. The world is not full of Raphaels either. Militaries need to identify the people who have this kind of talent, carefully nurture them, and put them in positions. In the German army, it was the Einsatz, the operations officer combined with chief of staff and sort of co-commander in ways that we can't quite grasp. That's where these guys went for the most part. And the German army constantly looked for these people. Von Moltke the Elder in the 1880s ordered the general staff to go out, and I quote, and recruit the eccentrics and the oddballs because they usually have the best ideas. Well, our military does not like eccentrics and oddballs. It wants conformists. I mean, John Boyd, the greatest military thinker this United States ever produced, retired as a colonel. So, yes, it's critical thinking, but it goes beyond critical thinking. It's a critical creative thinking, and it's the ability to think creatively in a military context. We do not look for the people who can do that, and as a result, most of our decisions are made by plotters who haven't a clue what they're doing substantively. By the way, have generally not read anything on war either. What they've done is gone to schools that's taught them process. It's paint-by-numbers war, and it looks just as good as paint-by-numbers art.
While we're getting near the end of the show, I wanted to kind of shift fire a little bit here because it's something that, you know, at least professionally has been curious to watch, especially. I'm a relatively young kid. I'm still under 50. I can say that for a few more years. But, for those that age and older who actually had to play around in the Cold War a bit, I wanted to get your take from a 4GW or other point of view, what we have seen this year in the Crimea and Ukraine, where the Russians have used one part special forces, the other part local thugs, the third part a pretty good PSYOPs, info ops program. And a lot of people who were too busy focused on the Pacific are now sitting there trying to wrap their head about what is the Russians are doing in Ukraine. From your point of view, how do you see that, how that operation has run, either from a Ukrainian or a Russian point of view, or from an objective point of view you may have yourself?
Well, Ukraine does not have viable borders at the moment because you have two peoples inside an artificial state. Ukraine was never a state. The Germans created it as a separate state in World War I, but it obviously didn't last very long. That aren't compatible, the Russians and the Ukrainians, because Stalin did as he did later to the Poles and Germans and just kicked the Ukrainians out of much of eastern Ukraine and filled it up with Russians. But the interesting thing here is not that the Ukrainian state's falling apart. It's a classic weak state that's going to do that. The interesting thing is that the Russians definitely have picked up a variety of techniques from fourth-generation forces. There's an excellent, I did a column on this recently, there is an excellent paper on this that goes into much more detail than I did, just put out by the Latvian Defense Academy, and it's in English, and I reference it in my most recent column. Again, this is my series on traditionalright.com. But as I noted in my column, the Russians are getting it at the level of techniques and maybe tactics, but they're not getting it at the much more important strategic level, where they don't seem to have grasped that the fundamental problem, which we saw in Iraq and which we have created again in Libya and we see now in Syria, is that once the state is destroyed, no one can put it back together. So in Ukraine, particularly in eastern Ukraine, Crimea was a little bit more of a classic coup de main with some fourth-generation techniques. But what the Russians have been doing in eastern Ukraine, they have clearly used some fourth-generation techniques, but they've missed the fourth generation context. Moscow did not ask itself sufficiently, okay, if we use these techniques, which are designed to make the state disintegrate, and that happens, then what?
You go on?
We are running out of time, Mr. Lynn, and I want to thank you for coming on our show and ask you what we can look forward to seeing from you in the next few months, weeks, whatever you got on the board we can look to direct our attention to?
My column for the American Conservative, that's six times a year because I write for the print edition, and then it takes a while before it's up on the website. The next one that I will send this coming week to the magazine, which will be for the next issue and then eventually up on the website, is on the canon. In effect, a follow-up to the piece we've been discussing today, because some officers have come back and said, okay, what should we read? Well, the starting place is the canon, the seven books. So that's something that that your listenership here might be interested in. I continue to write generally a weekly column, a successor to my old On War series, and I think all of the On War columns are up also on Traditional right now. The new series, The View from Olympus, since I have retired. And I do those weekly on military affairs. Plus, we're creating a sort of a research base on Traditional Right with things like the fourth generation manuals, the Austro-Hungarian Marine Corps manuals. Again, I'm retired at the moment, so I'm not slaving away at my typewriter the way I used to, but I've still got a reasonable output. And that's what's on deck.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time this afternoon, Bill, to come in and talk with us today, not just about your articles, but branching out into some other items as well. And just to remind everybody, we've been talking this hour with Mr. William S. Lind. And as you mentioned, you can find his more recent writings over at traditionalright.com and the American Conservative. Really appreciate you taking time, and as people who love books, we definitely like the reminder about the seven books. If people haven't looked into it, they really should.
And the rules of the game if you're Navy.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Okay,
and thank you,
bye.
Everybody, very much for joining us this edition of Midrat. Hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Until next time, cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go.
Farewell.